So Bob emails, what do you say?
Yeah.
This first email is from anonymous patron. She writes, this is a question for you and Bob, if he's available. Are you available, Bob?
I'm available right now.
Regarding betrayal trauma. I recently discovered my boyfriend cheated on me with someone we know. He said it was a one-off thing, but it clearly took some organizing.
Yeah.
And then through this, I discovered that he was talking with his ex-wife after previously he would be telling me, I only talk with my ex-wife every few months, but they're actually talking every couple of days.
Oof.
So basically, he admitted he was having an emotional affair with her.
Yes.
None of these behaviors line up with who I thought I knew him to be at all.
No.
I feel so scared about his request to move forward together with him because, one, I'm not sure if he can change, and two, how does one start to cultivate trust with a partner after something like this that avoid being controlling? I think, you know, she's saying, I have an impulse, I guess, to say you can't talk to any women for the rest of your life or something like that.
Right, some controlling.
But I don't want to do that. No. So how do I cultivate trust? I'm scared this might just be who he is and it will happen again. And I'm already in so much pain and feel so ashamed. Thank you for all you do for all of us. So Bob, what do you think?
Well, I'm very sorry. I think it's some of the worst pain that humans go through is this kind of betrayal. It sucks.
Yeah.
The two thoughts I have are, I'll try to be as brief as I can.
You don't have to be, Bob. You can be as lengthy as you want.
Oh, well.
People like it when you talk.
Well, this might take a bit then. In order to cultivate trust, there has to be a couple things to happen. One of them is you both have to understand what actually got injured. So like betrayal of trust, yes, that's a very way to talk about it. But what actually inside, what meaning does your body, does your heart make of that kind of betrayal? And that has to, as I understand it, you'll need to describe that both for yourself and for him. It could be very interesting, surprising, very intimate thing to do. And only if he's absolutely available to hear it. So you might need it might be good to have a therapist to accompany you in that particular journey. So that's the first thing. And I know I'm saying it, but see, the thing is like to touch that, it's like beneath my shock, beneath my horror, beneath my outrage is some exquisite pain. And whatever that exquisite pain is, needs to come to the surface and be expressed to the other who you will actually need to see. Remorse. Like, it's not enough for them to say, I'm sorry. Like, it actually has to show up in their face. And I think that that has a biologic component to it. Like, humans just need to see that the other person really, really cares and is in pain over the pain that they caused. That's the first bit. And then the second bit is to understand what the hell is going on here, that he's cheating with this person that you know and then still talking to his ex. Like, hey, he's not a bad person. Not a bad person, but what's up that he's doing that? Like, what's he doing opening all these windows to other people and clearly having doors for you? Like, something's driving that. That doesn't make him a jerk face, but it wouldn't be safe if that isn't understood. And if your relationship could possibly be a resource for whatever needs he's trying to get met by talking to, you know, and going outside your relationship. As Kirk has said before, and I often think about, it'll probably never go away entirely. And it doesn't have to. And the difference between, I think the difference between couples that survive this stuff and couples that, you know, suffer from it is how willing are both people to, when it comes around again, if it's in 5 months or 5 years or 5 decades, when it visits, how do they handle it? The person that got hurt has to know that it's absolutely okay that the wound got evoked again for whatever reason, maybe an anniversary, maybe you drove past a restaurant in your town or something, who knows? Whatever it is that evokes it, and the other person that did the betraying has to recognize that this does not mean that they're the bad guy who will never live it down. It means that they have a golden opportunity to provide love and support for somebody who's in fucking agony. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. Yeah, the only thing I'll add to that is often society or even people that you talk to, anonymous patron, will give the impression that you're supposed to figure this out right away.
No, no.
And if, you know, it depends on the circumstances, but if you think that it's worth actually giving it some time to figure out the relationship is worth it or there's enough indication like this might work out or something, then you just have to know that there's almost no way, even if he were a complete open book and said everything that was going on, and he was very self-aware, it would still take a lot of time for you to figure out what's going on, for your relationship, for him to recover. In all likelihood, in light of what Bob is bringing up, it's like, well, what's going on with him? There's a chance that this is like a 25-year journey that the two of you go on.
Oh, yeah.
Where there's lots of twists and turns.
Yeah.
So you just won't know, and that's okay.
Yeah.
It sucks to not know.
Right.
Now, if that's a deal breaker and you just don't want to take that risk and you don't want to take that time, you don't want to spend 5 years, exploring something only to find out that he is, quote unquote, just like that, or doesn't really love you, or his issues are too big, or he doesn't want to work on those issues, or you've fallen out of love with him sufficiently that it's not worth it to you.
Yeah.
If you don't want to spend that time, then, pulling the plug now, there's nothing wrong with that.
Nope.
So, but it sounds like you're maybe contemplating trying to see if this can work, and just get a good therapist that understands what we're talking about right here, and there are many therapists that understand it, and settle in for a good 2 to 3 years of therapy before you can really, you can evaluate along the way. There'll be little milestones, 2 months in, 6 months in, there'll be milestones where you can think, like, have we progressed a little bit?
Right.
Do I see signs that he is this? What's going on here? But you won't really know until you go through that.
Yeah.
Another.
I feel sad just hearing it. I'm so sorry.
Yeah. 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 It's so devastating to love someone and give to someone and to believe that someone is what they say, to believe someone is what you want them to be, what they say they are, the way they present to you, and then to find out that not only cheating, but that for a long period of time.
Man.
You know, I've talked about this before, and when was I talking about this in a reaction video? I can't remember. But the mind screw that it does to people is, okay, wait. Yeah, because it's one thing if you had a fling one night or something. It's another thing if it's going on for years.
Oh, yeah.
Where, okay, wait, so when we had that romantic dinner,
right?
Were you texting her then?
Right.
Were you thinking about her then?
Right.
When you said I was the only one and you only talked to your ex-wife every few months, and you kissed me that, or we made love that one time, was that false?
Yeah.
Because there's a falsehood to what you were doing then.
Yeah.
Is anything true?
Right.
Are you ever honest? Are you ever telling the truth? So, yeah, it's really a mind screw. And then you start thinking, can I trust anybody?
Yeah.
Is everyone lying to me?
I know. That that sucks.
How do I know?
Right.
There's no way to know.
There isn't.
I'm now discovering you are fundamentally have been lying to me for a long time.
Yeah.
And I thought I could trust you more than I could trust anyone else.
Right.
Therefore, it really fucks you up. And people, stop cheating. Stop lying. Stop cheating. Stop lying. Figure shit out. Go to therapy. Break up, but don't deceive.
Yeah.
Don't fuck around. You get one chance on this planet. Don't fuck it up.
Yeah.
And fuck it up for other people.
Yeah.
Fuck it up for yourself. Don't fuck it up for other people. Don't fuck it up for yourself. But if you're going to fuck it up for someone, fuck it up for yourself. Don't fuck it up for everyone else on the planet. Yeah. And, it's not only just me yelling at people for that, but also, shaking fist at society, which is that I wouldn't be surprised if a good number of cheaters have friends and people online that say, like, oh, you deserve to speak your truth or to get your needs met, or, because there's usually justifications that people have, she won't
wrong.
Have sex with me anymore something like that. And it's like, this idea of this sort of noble cheating, I think is a phrase, like
that's crazy.
Like, good for you kind of a thing.
Hey, people deserve to get their needs met. So great. But you don't gotta lie to do it.
Yeah.
Like, if they're really your needs, then let's put the cards on the table and say, declare it. This is my need.
Yeah.
Yeah. Screw
or break up
down.
And find someone
or break
else.
Up. Yep. That's fine.
Yeah.
One of the things that's injurious to people is my partner is now no longer predictable. I don't know what they are. I don't know what they're doing.
I don't even know who they are. I don't know what's going on in their heart.
Right. Yeah.
So much of a relationship
Yeah.
And the connection has to do with mentalization. It has to do with,
yeah,
I have a reasonable idea. I've reasonable confidence in my conceptualization of what is going on,
right,
in your heart.
Yeah.
That you like me and love me and look out for me and,
right,
prefer me or whatever.
Yeah.
And to have that get flipped on its head, then, you know, because we always, you know, we talk about communication and showing your love. Well, if someone is quote unquote showing their love, but you know it to be lying to you, it's not love. You're not receiving love. You're receiving this shadow of love. So you don't want to screw with that. You don't want to live a life that makes other people question your ability to communicate to them what's going on in your heart. Because,
right,
if no one trusts you, then no one's going to want to be with you.
Right, right.
And even when you're trying to build a connection, they won't trust it.
Yeah.
Even if you're legitimately trying.
The other thing I want to say about this is devices. If you've cheated on somebody, give them your fucking devices. Just let them look as often as they need to. Don't have shit to hide and just give it up. Nobody's privacy is that big a fucking deal that you can't. Because believe me, what'll happen is they will get zero relief from looking at your device. Because when they don't find anything, they're going to freak out. Because not finding stuff is worse than finding stuff. Because now you're like in the dark. So just don't fight it. And don't grudge it.
I'm confused. What are you saying?
I'm saying that when a person gets caught cheating and the person that got cheated on wants to see the devices, you know, let's say that they're on the straight and narrow. They're not doing it anymore. They broke off the relationship and they're just, okay, I'm devoted, I'm committed, and it's the real thing.
Yeah.
Then when that person has a fucking insecure moment at 11:30 on a Thursday and they need to see the goddamn device, just give it to them. And what'll happen is they'll look and they won't find anything. And not finding anything is not a relief. It just means, fuck, maybe I don't know where to look. Maybe you've got some fucking email that you don't tell me about, or a burner phone or some shit. Their brain will come up with some way in which you were lying, and they'll be more freaked out by looking. But at least initially, they have to look. They just have to. Mm-hmm. And, you know, fuck it, fine. Give them the goddamn device. Nobody's privacy. I hear this about, oh, you know, my privacy, blah, 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 blah. Fucking bullshit. Your fucking privacy, man. Fuck your privacy. You gave that up. And let's face it, if you really want to help somebody, if you really love that person, and not only just for your own well-being and welfare, want the relationship to survive, then fucking give up the goddamn device. Because think about what you just did to them. You just undermined all their confidence in you, and rightfully so, because you undermine all their goddamn confidence in you. So everybody has this thing about, well, it's my device, you know, it's my phone, nobody has a right to it. Yeah, fuck you. No. Fucking give the goddamn thing up.
Yeah.
And let them look. In fact, offer it. Don't wait. And don't grudge it. Just here.
Yeah.
Why don't we look together?
Yeah.
Why don't I just sit with you while you don't find anything, and I can love you while you're in pain? Mm-hmm. Like, why the fuck not? Mm-hmm. Golly.
There's a cultural notion that I think is dominant that informs that resistance. That it's my privacy.
Fuck that.
And I think that where it comes from is from a couple sources, because I'd never thought about this, but before there were devices, like with my parents, when I was a kid, my parents had no privacy because it wasn't possible to have privacy because everything was out there. There was one telephone in our house. Yeah,
maybe you have a diary.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Maybe, but my parents didn't.
No.
So
nobody has a diary.
You don't. And I'm thinking there's a comfort to that, right? And a connection, a knowing that someone.
We're all on page here. Like, you don't have an avenue to privacy.
Well, not only that, but you're in each other's lives. You're truly entwined.
Right.
Do you get to have some privacy? Sure. Could you have a private conversation with someone? Could you do something with someone else? But
right.
But anyway, but yeah, I think that it comes from a couple places. One is that there's a lot of people who grew up with parents who were trying to invade their space with their device. You and I didn't grow up that way.
No.
And so I think it kind of ingrains this notion of like, it's my right to have privacy.
Yeah.
And okay. But I think another avenue towards this cultural notion is that you have some partners who are paranoid unreasonably and are demanding to have access to another person's phone when there's no indication of infidelity that's happening.
Mm-hmm.
And it's abusive, right? It can even get to that level where they're the abusive person will be like, you have no privacy. Yeah. I'm going to get into your phone.
I'm going to control this. And
I'm going to spy on you. I'm going to I'll put software in your phone.
Oh,
you know, so gross. there's this heuristic, this shortcut people have around people deserve their privacy. And in those situations, I don't know about the teens. It's debatable. But but certainly for abuse victims, they deserve their privacy.
Oh, hell yeah.
So I think that it all gets sort of translated.
Mushed into.
Absolutely. I think your frustration comes from a frustration that I've often expressed on this podcast, that if you cheat and you truly want to recover, which often is the case when people are in my office, the cheater wants to gain trust back.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they resist every possible avenue or measure that could be taken to build that trust back.
Including not ending the fucking cheating.
Right.
Occasionally.
But let's say they do that.
Yeah.
And you know, we talk about the topic of access to phone or email or something. And, I'm never forcing a client to do that, but it is something that I might throw out there as a possibility. And, you know, if the cheater has a hard line on that, there's other ways we can do this. But why would you not? Unless there's a really compelling reason, like, well, my dad talks with me a lot about his issues and I don't want that and to be out there, or I have a friend who this, or I have a job that does this.
Okay, yeah, top secret security clearance.
Yeah. But that's not usually the case. It's usually just like, but I don't want to give up my
privacy. Want to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, you paid the crime. You got to do the time.
Yeah, dude.
Like,
what?
Like, you should be champing at the bit to actually give him access.
I get to help you?
Right.
I get to, and all I have to do is hand you this piece of metal?
Right.
That's easy.
Right.
Here you go.
Yeah, yeah.
And you get to get relief from it, and we get to care about you while,
right.
I mean, come on.
Right.
That's a no-brainer.
Yeah. But there's also a lot of other cultural notions around people holding on to the past, and the cheater goes to their friends or goes online and talks about the situation. They're going to get a lot of people are being like, your therapist is making you do what? You know, there's a lot of pro-cheater culture in our culture.
I'm not online. I'm really glad I'm not online.
Well, it's a reflection of our culture. You know?
Yeah, no,
if you are around the water cooler in the 90s, it would be a similar conversation, I think.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Anyway.
I'm not around the water cooler either.
Yeah, you're pretty cut off from...
I am.
Human beings aside from your clients, and your wife. All right, let's take a break and we get back more emails. What do you say?
Right on.
Okay, we're back from the break. So patron Crystal from California, she says, I have a question for you and Bob. I was recently watching an interview on YouTube where the interviewee, let's call her Kate, was talking about her experience in therapy. So Kate's on YouTube talking about therapy. Mm-hmm. And Kate says that her therapist once told her that she was too self-aware and that there was nothing she, the therapist, could do to help her. Oh. So the therapist says, you're just too self-aware. There's nothing more I can do.
Huh.
In the YouTube video, Kate was saying that basically in therapy, she would say, this thing happened to me as a kid because of this, so now I do this and this.
Uh-huh.
So the Kate person had a lot of self-awareness as to how her present behavior relates to her childhood traumas and that sort of thing.
Great.
Kate said she appreciated that the therapist was upfront with saying that she didn't know what to do with Kate.
Huh.
Kate didn't continue seeing the therapist after this, and it was insinuated in the YouTube video that the therapist may have even terminated with her because of this you're too self-aware thing.
Huh.
And so Crystal from California goes on, I've had a similar issue, and at times I also feel too self-aware for therapy. Like I already know what my bad coping mechanisms are and why I have them. So therapy just isn't helpful sometimes. I don't think this is an uncommon sentiment though, and I think hyper self-awareness can be a trauma response itself. Have you ever dealt with a client who was too self-aware? What do you do when therapy doesn't seem to be working for a client? Would you ever terminate with a client over something like this, Bob?
I'm thinking about... Oh, back when I was young, I used to see this really lovely man. And I didn't get to see him very long because it was right before I left the clinic where I was working. So maybe a few months. And he was smart, smart, smart. Like went to one of those like MIT kind of schools, smart, like really smart. And he'd talk. And I would be overwhelmed because he could talk circles around me. And I'm not a dummy, right? And I know how to put a noun and verb together, but I used to get like just sort of overwhelmed. And so occasionally what I'd say to him is, well, you know, you're a lot smarter than me. So can you just tell me what I'm going to say? just do my end too. We'd have a laugh about it. And so I don't buy this notion of too self-aware. I don't even know what that really means. I mean, I think it's great if you're psychologically minded and you are self-aware and you're able to, you know, look at yourself, maybe, you know, like step back a bit and look at yourself and see, you know, even validate, see how your behavior makes sense. But I don't think that's why, at least the people that I see, that's not why they're coming to therapy. They're not coming to therapy because they're too self-aware, or that's not a symptom of a problem. And it sounds like it's kind of a cognitive intellectualization of, I don't know what, growth, maturity or something. I don't know. What's it like to be in the presence of the other and be seen and cared for? That's what I'm interested in. So what I'm curious about with Kate is, what about that element? Because maybe the therapist was intimidated. Maybe the therapist was scared, or maybe the therapist thought their job was to teach. You know, maybe that's a part of our job. I guess occasionally that's something. I mean, I wouldn't want to rule it out entirely on the one hand. But on the other hand, I can do therapy with people that are very self-aware and offer something really useful, which is care.
You're very self-aware.
I am.
You might be the most self-aware client in the city limits of Seattle.
Well, shit. I haven't seen anybody else at the meetings.
And yet, you're still in therapy and will be for a long time.
Yeah, probably.
So what is the agent of change in your therapy?
It's care.
And how does that change? What's the change?
Slowly. I go to therapy every Tuesday at 9. And when I show up, I'm coming in there forgetting that he actually likes me and cares about me. And that, honest to God, last week I said to him, I don't know why I sit down here and I feel like I'm going to be lectured to or talked down to by my dad. And I told him some story, but that was coming to mind about some crappy thing that happened between me and my dad when I was 19 or 18 or whatever, a long time ago. And I forget that he doesn't do that. I don't know why that is. Like, I wish I could have more object permanence about the fact that my therapist cares about me.
Well, it's kind of the problem. You have object permanence with your dad.
Yeah, I do. Right, I do. And it's the negative kind of object permanence and the expectation of whatever. And so therapy for me is chipping away at that, that I'm actually not there to perform. I'm not there to impress. I'm not there to be self-aware. I'm there to be loved and to try to remember.
And only through that experience will you remember.
Yeah.
And only through that experience will you not have that transference, will you not have that assumption. Only through the experience can you counteract the millions of interactions you had with your dad.
Can't think your way out of that one. You just can't.
Yeah. You're very self-aware of that.
I am aware.
You know that. You've been back and forth. You've talked about it with him, with yourself, with me, with others. Yeah. You know the whole ball of wax.
Yeah.
You're what too self-aware means, but you're very self-aware.
Yeah.
And yet you're still in therapy.
Yeah.
And it's still helping you change.
Right. So for Crystal, I guess I'm thinking, why don't you just, if you're in therapy, why don't you just talk about what it's like to be in therapy and be self-aware if that's what it is. Like, I noticed that I'm aware of this. Okay, great. Good. And what's going on between us right now? What's happening here in our relationship? But I'm a believer in attachment-oriented psychotherapy. Mm-hmm. You know, not all therapists believe in that or do that. And, you know, I think that there's a place for CBT. Yeah, there's a place for that. And it's great. You know, that's fine. And there's evidence behind it. And a good CBT therapist is not without care, I hope. I don't think they are, though maybe some of them are. I don't know. Doesn't matter. In my opinion, that's not where I should restate. I think for a lot of things, that's not sufficient. And attachment-oriented therapy is curative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it depends what we're trying to cure.
Well, that's
so
true.
So to go through your email, Crystal, you say that Kate was too self-aware and that in therapy she would say, this thing happened to me as a kid because of this, you know, I was abused by my dad because my dad was abused as a kid. So now because of that, I was abused. Now I will see abuse where it's not really happening, or I will become abusive or something like this.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's very self-aware.
Yeah.
I can't imagine what being too self-aware would look like.
Yeah.
Like somehow your brain has burst out of your head or something. And how can you be, there's no such thing as being too self-aware.
What is the therapist trying to communicate in that? It's other than rejection.
But it also implies that you shouldn't be that self-aware. Like you should stop with your self-awareness before a certain threshold, because if you do too much self-awareness, it's a bad thing. I think literally there are people who believe that. And I think some therapists might believe that.
Well, apparently this one did.
Yeah. There's a possibility the therapist just felt inept.
Yeah, that's my guess.
And it's just like, you're annoyingly self-aware. You're more self-aware than I could even imagine giving you. And so that's annoying to me. So I'm going to say you're too self-aware.
Yeah.
Also, there's a shaming of therapy and self-awareness in our society. And so I think people will say, you know, you think too much. People say, you know, I overthink.
Yeah. Annoying.
And it depends on the situation, but often what I'll hear or what I'll evaluate when people say that someone is overthinking or they themselves are overthinking is that they are thinking about something that's scaring them and they are backed into a corner and they don't know what to do. So mm-hmm. they're thinking about it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And to imply that the individual should just stop thinking about it is somehow denying human reality of emotions and stuff, and denial of emotions.
Right.
And so I think it sounds like it's kind of in that camp.
Yeah.
But the way that, Crystal, you're talking about this Kate person is that Kate seemingly didn't need therapy because there, at least the way you depicted it, there wasn't a thing that Kate was saying, even though I'm aware of it, I still have this issue, mm-hmm. you know. So Bob would say, even though I'm aware that my abuse childhood history affects my perception mm-hmm. and ability to absorb love from other people,
mm-hmm.
Even though I'm aware of it, I still will fall into that mm-hmm. mindset, and I need to go through the mindset mm-hmm. to counter it with a corrective experience so that I can internalize that and actually believe and trust that not only love will happen, but that it's safe to open myself up.
Right.
And I need to go through that. It sounds like for this Kate character, there wasn't anything like that. They might actually have succeeded in therapy such that they're self-aware, and now they're tasked with just enacting that self-awareness, and there isn't anything beyond that, or at least that's noticeable to Kate.
Yeah.
But Crystal, the way you talk about therapy is that you're very self-aware, but therapy isn't helping. You say, I already know my bad coping mechanisms and why I have them. And mm-hmm. so, Crystal, I'll just say, that's great.
Yep.
Over time, I've really tried to develop a foundational understanding of the agent of change and therapy. And in a nutshell, and I've said this before, there are two pillars of therapy. One is self-awareness and one is corrective experience or healing. For everybody, self-awareness will help
mm-hmm.
To differing degrees, and it depends on the situation. But self-awareness is only half of the equation. The other half is actually having the corrective experiences that will change your personality and your reactivity as such that you won't have the need for self-awareness in the moment. You know, like with Bob, let's say, I don't think this will happen, but let's say that in 5 years, you have enough corrective experiences such that you don't have any reactivity to getting close to people, or you have the normal amount of reactivity, then you wouldn't necessarily need the self-awareness of why you might react in a distorted way based on your past abuse history, because it doesn't come up.
It doesn't come up.
Yeah. So the self-awareness and the corrective, the self-awareness leads to the ability to frame your experiences in a corrective way such that you can change the personality and heal such that you don't need the self-awareness anymore. I mean, you always need some self-awareness.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I'm guessing that you just haven't met the right therapist.
Mm.
The other possibility is that you haven't presented the right problem to the therapist. The other possibility is that I think as Bob was sort of alluding to with the MIT guy, is that, and I've worked with clients like this too, where, and there's no indication of this directly, Crystal, but you know, narcissism is a thing. It's a protective measure mm-hmm. of I am superior to my therapist mm-hmm. or I don't really need help. So with the people with narcissistic, you know, they're on the narcissistic spectrum that I've treated, they will have reached a point in their life where they're at such a crisis that they know they need help. There's something going on with them. And so they end up in therapy. But when they sit down, of course, they transfer and they're scared and they're worried, and they have a lot of issues as children reaching out for help, and they were rejected over time. And so it's hard to tolerate the action of therapy where they're actually just handing themselves over and interacting in a close way with their therapist. And so for a long while, the client will stay in therapy because they know they want to be there, but they'll keep the therapist at arm's length. And one of the ways that there's different styles of narcissism, but one of the styles is to pontificate and to appear smart, to appear like you don't need anything. Yeah. Like the, I don't know about you, Bob, but the counter transference that I'll feel with someone in this camp is I will slowly start to feel like I don't matter and that I'm a terrible therapist. I'll even kind of throw stuff out there and the client will be like, yeah, that's not really the issue. Anyway, moving on. And, you know, they just gallop down the road.
Yeah.
And it's like I'm not even there. Yeah. You know what I mean? Right. And I'll start to feel bad. I'll start to get hurt. I'll start to get angry.
Right.
And when I notice that, I'm like, oh, okay. And then I know that the transference and the counter transference, I know the trauma, that's how they felt when they were growing up. And so it gives me a way forward. I don't necessarily do something with it right away, but it gives me ability to frame it. So, you know, there's a possibility. If someone came to me and said, so I'm in therapy, it doesn't usually work for me, but, and I'm, you know, I've been told I'm too self-aware for therapy. And so I don't have a lot of confidence this is going to work, but I'm hoping that it will work. I would, on the list of, my short list of hypotheses would be that the person has a protective part of their personality that pushes people away in this way and tries to appear that they're independent and don't need any help. And along these lines, and I think what you're getting at, Bob, is someone could come into, and I've done this before too, I'm sure you have, and I've framed it this way. So I don't require self-awareness at up front. So a client could come to me and I can try to work on self-awareness, but if it doesn't seem to work, or the or it's a child, like they're five, and there's not a lot of diagrams that they're going to absorb about counter-transference and abuse and this sort of thing.
Sure.
I will forego self-awareness for the other pillar, which is corrective experience.
Yeah.
It helps if they're self-aware because then they can actually do things in the moment and frame things in a more corrective way for them. But it's not necessary. You can do only corrective experiences with people and have that result in change for them. You know what I mean?
I was just thinking about this man. I really liked him. I really liked him a lot. And he had been through several therapists in the clinic. And I used to approach our meetings with empty hands. He could dismiss me. We used to joke that he could crush me with his iron boot of intelligence. Being empty-handed and not needing him to do anything for me, I think was really helpful to him. It gave him a space and some freedom. And I only saw him for a few months. And at the end, he said to me, he said, you're the best therapist I had here. I said, well, thank you. And then he laughed and he's like, I'm not saying you're a good therapist. I'm just saying you're the best. So I laughed with him because it's really funny, you know, and it was also his way of keeping distance. But it's like he could reach for me with his back to me and his hand out. Mm-hmm. He could stick his hand back behind him to try to reach for me. And that was the best he could do. Mm-hmm. And I accepted that. And that was fine.
Mm-hmm.
Good guy. Really good. I think about him very fondly.
Narcissistic guy, but good guy.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, let's take a break. All right, back from the break. Annual anonymous patron, she says, lately I've been listening to a lot of episodes with you and Bob, where he gets vulnerable with you, which inspired me to write this email. In your most recent patron Q&A on YouTube, I do these YouTube live streams and people ask questions in the comment section and I'll answer them on the air. I asked a question, so she asked a question. It was about the difference between flaw shame and effectiveness schema. So just chiming in here, I coined, I think, this term flaw shame in relation to OCPD, obsessive compulsive personality disorder, that I think at the, you know, for borderline, it's abandonment trauma, and I think for OCPD, the core is flaw shame, that you've been shamed for being flawed in some way. You've been criticized and rejected because of that. And so she's saying, I asked about what's the difference between flaw shame and defectiveness schema. It was something I had been wondering about for a while because I can identify with both, but I assumed I am likely just confusing one for the other. So just chiming in because I think this goes to another topic, but
yeah.
The way I would answer that today, and I hope I answered it this way in the moment, I can never know, is that there's a difference. It can result in the same, you know, if you're flamed for shots, if you're shamed for having flaws as a child, then you can develop a defective ischemia, meaning that you believe that you're defective at your core and there's really nothing that can change that. And you just have to hide it. If people really knew you, they would see just how worthless and rejectable you are. But that's only one avenue of that trauma. Another avenue is to say, I'm going to be perfect.
Yeah.
And I can achieve that. You can also have both, but they're different. You know what I mean? And might flaw shame, might someone with OCPD deep down, is there an inherent element of some deep down imperfection that you have to mask? Yeah, you could word it that way. But in description and in narrative and in vibe, it's a different experience. Bob, you have a defective ischemia. You believe that you're defective deep down, correct?
Yeah.
Why do you answer it that way?
Because it's fun. Oh.
I was like, did we not talk about that?
No, we did.
Sure.
We have indeed.
Whereas I have flaw shame, I'm perfectionist. Now, you might also be. Are you perfectionist as well?
I have my moments, yeah.
Yeah. But I don't have defective ischemia. I don't believe deep down that I am unlovable or rejectable. I don't see that in myself because I wasn't treated in that way.
So would you say that you're not mindful or vigilant about a flaw being revealed? Or
no.
It only comes up if one happens to surface, you flub a note on your guitar or something.
Well, it's different to be seen as being flawed or to make a mistake than to be inherently deep down.
To believe.
Like, yeah. At my core, regardless of what I do. Like, I guess with flaw shame, it has more to do with action and observation.
Yeah.
Then it has to do with baseline, you're just like disgusting and gross and
self-perception or
and
whatever.
Dirty or nothing, yeah. Or something.
Right. Yeah.
Those now might some people kind of word them similarly.
I can see the, yeah.
But as someone who has a mild case of flaw shame and definitely does not have defective ischemia,
yeah.
I could say that they are not one and the same.
They're not the same. Yeah.
So she goes on, the thing is, I never participate in Q&As online out of fear.
Oh.
I overcame this fear by reminding myself of your compassion.
Oh.
But as soon as I hit send, I felt an enormous wave of panic and shame.
Mm.
I felt like my question was extremely stupid, unintelligent, showing that I know nothing about this topic. I also felt guilty about selfishly posting my question and expecting you to spend time on it. Looking back on it later, your answer was very helpful and interesting, and I appreciate it a lot. But at the moment, all I could hear was that you were judging me for being stupid and looking down at me.
Oh, man.
And just chiming in here, I would never think that.
Of course not.
It's just like not a thing I would think ever.
No, you appreciate that people are interested and want to talk about this stuff and are curious like you and enjoy, you know.
Yeah. If anything, I'm like thinking everyone thinks I'm stupid. but I would never think that about someone that wrote in like that.
Yeah.
From your podcast, I have learned enough to know this likely has little to do with reality, thinking I'm stupid, and comes from my childhood traumas.
Mm.
But I would really appreciate it if you could tell me how you experience such questions so I can actually internalize it. I think it might be a valuable corrective experience for me. Mm. Just chime in here. Yeah, well, anonymous patron, when I'm at my sort of cruising speed, which isn't my best speed, I am not really thinking about the personality of the person asking the question because live Q&A, there's a scrolling live stream chat that's just going by very quickly and I'm trying to think on my toes. And so I'm in my own head trying to be of service to the audience. And so I read a question and there's no time in my or space in my brain to contemplate what your personality is or if you're stupid or smart or anything. I'm just like, I'm flying by the seat of my pants. So that's my cruising speed. At best, though, when I hear a question like that, I imagine that the individual has one or both, and I feel bad for that person. And I also feel very, especially a question like that, because I would suspect that you learn those concepts from me. So you're like connected to me. You've been with me. You're like a, not really, but kind of like a student or a supervisee that has contact with me, someone that's in my life, someone that says, what's the difference between flaw, shame, and defective schema? There's so much implied contact that we've had, and that closeness feels good to me. And extremely gratifying that, because that's really one of the best experiences that you can have. I guess you can have this as a therapist as well, but I think it's more likely to show up as a professor that, and maybe when you were doing the DBT classes, you would probably have this. So there'd be a point where the student in your class would ask a question or say something to someone else in the group that would indicate that they have really absorbed what you have been trying to get across to them, and they believe it, they've internalized it, it's theirs now. And your language or, you know, your terms, things that you know that they did not have prior to entering the class, they are now using themselves. They're comfortable with it. They believe in it. They understand it. They get it. They're using it in a way that is helpful to themselves. You know, how did that feel when that would happen?
Oh, is there higher praise?
Yeah.
I don't think there is, you know, when you live inside the mind and heart of another, and that they're grabbing hold of something that they find useful and helpful. Yeah, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
That's how
anonymous patron.
That's how they sound. Like they've done that. It's fantastic.
Right. Yeah, and taking care of themselves because they deserve it, right?
Yeah.
So, at best, that's how I'm thinking.
Yeah.
So I hope that is a corrective experience for you, patron. The other thing I'll say, anonymous patron, is let's say in this weird, bizarro world, I did think you were dumb. That's not on you. That would be on me.
Yeah.
Just because someone thinks you're dumb, which happens, does not mean you are dumb.
Yeah.
So that's another part of this corrective experience is for me to tell you as a corrective experience that you don't have to listen to anyone say anything about you. You don't have to regard anything anyone says about you or believes about you. Even if you don't know they think I'm stupid. Maybe there's even indications. Even if I were to say that you're stupid, that does not matter because that is on me. I'm the stupid head. I'm the dumb one. I'm the hostile one. I'm the unfair one, not you. You are not blended with other people's thoughts of you. You are your own thing, your own pillar of awesomeness that has nothing to do with what other people think of you. You can regard it, and it's hard not to let it in. But even if someone did think you're stupid, that's, you know, it's sort of like at best, if I'm on the street or in public and some toxic male calls me a pussy or something, at my best, I'd be like, well, that's on you. Yeah. I feel bad, you know, internally, at least I'd be thinking my manhood or my worth as a human being is impervious to your random attempt at insulting me. It doesn't affect me. I'm strong enough. I know myself enough. Illogical for me to even think you would know who I am based on this road rage incident or something. So now I'm not usually like that because it's hard to be that way. But anyway, going on, I also just want to thank you and Bob. While writing this email terrifies me, I will send it, which I never would have done before I started listening to the podcast.
We're done.
You also helped me develop a lot of awareness for my issues. So thank you very much.
Right on.
You're very welcome.
Thanks for writing in.
Yeah. All right. One more email here, Bobby G.
Okay.
Upper tier patron, Arizona from Arizona. She says, from 2019 to 2021, I had a wonderful therapist. It was the most secure and corrective experience I have ever had, particularly with a male. At one point towards the end of the relationship, I made a mistake. I told him I was planning on having skin removal surgery to remove 10 pounds of extra skin after massive weight loss. He asked me directly, how much does it cost? So just chiming in here, what do you think about a therapist asking a question like that?
Oh, I don't know what to think about it. It sort of depends on, you know, were they just sort of interested and curious?
Yeah.
Was there something on their mind around money or, you know, whatever? So I don't really know what to think.
Right.
So far, I don't have an opinion.
Yeah, same. I trusted him from the depths of my heart and told him the number. It was a high number, but I saved up the money for years and desperately wanted to feel comfortable in my own skin.
Wow.
And prevent skin infections. A few months later, he announced that he was no longer accepting insurance, but he was going to work with every client and that no one would be abandoned for financial reasons. So,
okay.
I have had this transition. Did you make this transition?
I can't say I did it like that, but I did make this transition.
From taking insurance to not taking insurance.
Yes.
And it sucks because it makes things less affordable to people.
Yeah. Yep.
But if we as clinicians are going to make a living and pay our bills and maybe have a tiny retirement fund, then this is kind of the way to go. The problem is that there's not enough funding and tax money spent on people getting access to therapy. It's not our fault for trying to actually have a career and not living week to week or month to month. Anyway, so yeah. And one of the worries that we have as therapists when we do this is that for some of our clients who we care about, it will be hard for them to afford us because they'll be going from a $10, $20 copay to maybe using out-of-network, which may or may not even work.
Right.
And so they might be going from $20 a week to $75 a week or maybe even $200 a week.
Right.
And for many therapists, and it sounds like her therapist said that he would work with people and say like, you know, if you can't afford 200, we'll bring it down to what you can afford.
Right.
Kind of sounds like that's what he was saying.
Yep.
But ultimately he didn't work with me. So I've read this email previously and it's a little hard for me to tell exactly what happened, but let me continue reading.
Sure.
I can't help but wonder if he wrote me off as being wealthy because I could afford that surgery and therefore was someone who would ultimately cave and pay up in order to bask in the only secure relationship that I had ever known.
Oh.
So just chime me in here. I read this email a bunch of times, and I kept trying to figure out what might have happened based on, I'm trying to read between the lines of like, what's the detail here? Because I have a hard time believing that he just said, I'm going to charge $200 an hour. That's my fee. And she was going from 20 to 200 and she couldn't afford 200. And I have a hard time that he was just like, well, because you had that surgery and you're a rich person, screw off or something. So I don't know, but I think there's a 50% chance based on what we're hearing that what might have happened is that he said this to her and all of his clients, and he felt bad about putting clients in that situation. And she presented to him, she's like, well, I can't afford X, but I can't afford Y. So is it okay if, or maybe even can I just keep it at my copay? And he at maybe immediately said, well, actually, I can't go down that low. Mm-hmm. My fee schedule's going to be, my lowest price will be 75 or something just like that.
Whatever, yeah.
And she couldn't afford that. And so he had to terminate with her. And so either he misspoke when he said, I'm going to work with all clients regardless, or he didn't really word it that way. And he kind of said it in a way that made her believe that no matter what, he would try to make it work with her. Because that's quite a statement. Like if someone came to me, I would never recommend that they say that to all their clients. Because, if they said that to me, I'd be like, so are you prepared to see a client for $30 or $0 an hour? Because what if the client, their copay, they lose the ability to even pay that, coinciding with you, you know, switching away from insurance. Are you prepared to see five clients at pro bono or something? Because there's a possibility that could happen. And if so, then okay, great. Because you're really opening yourself up to, what you want to say is I'm switching away from insurance. And for those of you who might have a hardship, let's talk about it.
Yeah.
And I have a fee schedule here based on your income. And if that doesn't work, then unfortunately, I will give you, you could say I'll give you five pro bono sessions, but we have to actually transition to another therapist.
To pretend you don't have limits is just silly.
Yeah, because it's just going to happen, I'm guessing that he switched away from insurance because he wanted to make more money to begin with. So to set yourself up for failure with
less money
is not a good idea.
And maybe they didn't think it through, whoever the therapist is, maybe.
Right. They were scared and they felt guilty. And so
a lot of therapists do feel guilty about money. And,
right. Yeah. Yeah. And I was guilty of that. I wouldn't even gather the money. I would just put it off and put it off. And then people would have these enormous balances. And then I had clients that didn't pay those balances. And I just said, well, that's kind of on me. Thousands and thousands of dollars. I'm pretty good with a lot of the professionalism of our profession, but that's just one of them that everyone was always better than me in that. Anyway.
Yeah.
So I think something happened there and she couldn't really afford, or he changed his mind later and said, well, actually, I guess I did say I'd work with everyone, but that's not really true.
Yeah.
And then he terminated with her, or they agreed to terminate because of the financial problems. That's what I think. Because I think if he just rejected her, like, you're a wealthy son of a bitch and I'm going to get rid of you, she would have mentioned something like that. So I'm guessing it had something to do with that. Okay.
Could be the therapist didn't know their limits until they crossed them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, nobody knows their limits until they cross them.
Right. Also, you could change your mind. You could, in the moment, say, I'm willing to work with everyone. And then 6 months later, you're like, actually, I don't want to do that.
Yeah,
that's okay.
Yeah.
It's not great business to set up that expectation, and maybe you could be liable for something like that, but I don't imagine that.
There's nothing unethical about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like McDonald's says, you know, we're going to charge $1 for a burger, and then later on they say we're raising the price. Now, if McDonald's says something like, we are never raising our price above $1,
right,
then, you know, then you have a problem, and maybe the therapist did that. I don't know.
Yeah.
But the leap that the client is making is that the reason why it broke down was because she told him how much her surgery cost. And she's concluding that it's because of that, which
we can't.
So she asks, was it ethically questionable for him to ask me how much I paid for the surgery? I have been permanently scarred by this experience. Okay. So is it ethical that he asked the question?
Yeah. Yeah. There's nothing wrong with that question. And if you're in therapy with somebody and something like this comes up, you get to talk about it.
Right.
Like, it feels weird for you to know, or, you know, like, that feels invasive if that's the case, or whatever.
Or are you terminating with me because of that?
Do you have some impression about how much money I have?
Yeah, and this is in the context of what she's saying as a wonderful therapist who was very secure. So we could guess and say that he's not this conniving Machiavellian a-hole.
Probably not.
I will say, though, that if I heard a clip from a therapy session of a colleague or a supervisee, and I, you know, it sounds like it immediately that's the question he asked, I would ask the clinician, why did you ask that question? I wouldn't say it's a bad question, but what was the impulse there? Because if there was a clinical reason, that I'd be, oh, okay. And then I might say, well, you didn't really make that very clear, because the way it came across, it sounded like you were just kind of curious or interested. It could come across wrong, because, you know, you get into topics like that.
Yeah.
Plus, like, for this individual, the body shame or the life goal of getting the body that feels right to them is a big emotional deal for them. And for you to just micro ask a question like that of how much does it cost, you know, it's like someone's telling you about how they were abused as a kid, and you're just like, what outfit was your dad wearing at the time?
Yeah.
Like, well, what does it matter? Right. Well, I don't know. I'm just curious. You know, it derails people.
Right.
So I don't know what's going on there, but maybe there's a justification like, well, I know the therapist could say that I know that she really struggled with money, and we had actually talked about how sometimes she would overspend and so that. But I could honestly, given the context, see a therapist saying, yeah, I don't really know why I asked that question. I was just kind of curious because I was watching this show about those kinds of surgeries, and I'd heard that they were really expensive, and I was just kind of curious, like, how much does something like that cost? Because it's probably, is it a lot of money? Are we talking like 50 grand, or are we talking like 2 grand? Like, what are we talking about here? Like, you can imagine a therapist just being kind of, and maybe the therapist was that loose. Maybe the therapist is that kind of therapist where they're just kind of more casual in their questions, which, you know, anyway. So to answer your question, based on your description, patron, was it ethical? Yeah, it's not unethical going on. I have been permanently scarred by this experience. I still cry about it. Aww. This is 2 years ago, termination. I still cry about it. I have intrusive thoughts every day, and I feel trauma. I feel the trauma well up in my throat whenever I think of him. I have been considering filing a complaint with the board. For me to feel this way after more than a year, something went terribly wrong. But I don't know if an ethical violation of substance occurred. Any thoughts, Bob?
I don't hear an ethical violation. I hear a lot of pain about what sounds like an abrupt, you know, termination and a sense of rupture. Yes, of course you can file a complaint. That is absolutely, you're right. I don't know that, based on what's here, that an ethics board will do much.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that they should. I don't know if they should.
Depends on the circumstance.
It depends on the circumstance, but.
Yeah. I mean, termination is a flashpoint for complaints being honored by a licensing board or in a court of law when you're being sued. You mm-hmm. know, it's one of those things that I had to kind of learn as time went on, that when we terminate with clients, we have to really make sure we're doing it right yeah. and that we're buttoned up. Mm-hmm. And if there's a rupture, that you try to minimize that as best as you can. And because once you terminate, if the rupture grows, which it sounds like it has with this client, yeah. then you're not there to counteract it or help with it at all.
Yeah, right.
And harm can occur. And a year or two later, the client could end up having it balloon so large that they end up taking action against you. So right. Making sure that you terminate well, also around suicidality and that kind of thing.
Right.
But anyway, Yeah, first off, it sounds like you're suffering greatly from the loss of that relationship.
Yeah.
And it sounds weird, but I would recommend going to therapy to help recover from that loss.
Yeah.
Sounds weird, but we've given that recommendation to other people before.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds like for you, patron, you have relational traumas around abandonment or abuse or something,
yeah.
denial of a secure relationship. And this relationship was very valuable to you. And to lose it is devastating. You might even say it's the one secure relationship that you had, and to have that end based on how you perceive, at the very least, putting aside the surgery that you went through, at the very least, he wasn't willing to lower his fee such that you could continue to see him. You know, that hurts.
Yeah, that hurts.
That's rough.
Yeah.
I mean, that, and it is something to think about for you clinicians out there, because if I were in that situation, if I had a client that I thought there was a 20% chance that no matter what I did in the termination, if I did everything perfectly, that the client 2 years later would be traumatized by this break, I personally would not terminate. I would see that client pro bono, because I would say to myself, why am I on this planet if not to do that good?
Right.
Why did I become a therapist? Yes, it sucks that I have to bite the bullet monetarily, but you know, I'll make up for it in this other way. You know, I won't budge with these other clients about this sort of thing, or I'll make sure that I have a fee structure such that I can pay my bills, you right. know, and
or learn whatever I needed to learn based on this, you know, circumstance. Like maybe their fee is too low. Like in general, their fee is too low and they don't have room in their practice for pro bono. Oh, that's important learning. So if I'm going to keep a client pro bono, then set it up so that the rest of my practice can support that.
Right.
Yeah.
And so that's me. But if someone said, I can't really do that, I wouldn't fault them. It just sucks.
No, it sucks.
It's just one of those things, one of those unfortunate aspects of the profession of being a therapist. You know, sometimes you move or you get sick or yeah. you want to change careers and you shut down your practice. And if you're the sort of therapist like Bob and I, then you're going to have these attachment oriented clients that no matter what you do, it's going to be a huge loss for them. That's going to involve a lot of grief.
Yeah.
So it sucks. And you deserve to recover from it. And if you found a therapist, for example, and you did develop a good enough secure attachment with that other therapist, might even be deeper, who knows, mm-hmm. and you heal to some extent from that previous therapeutic relationship, you know, a couple years' time, you could be better off than you ever were. You know, it's this isn't like you're doomed and there's no hope in sight, you know. Yeah. So it sucks, and I'm sorry that happened. As Bob said, you could file a complaint if you want to, but I doubt the board would investigate. And even if they did investigate it, I'm guessing that he could provide an acceptable explanation as to why he changed his fee or why he terminated.
Yeah.
And even if they did sanction him, which would be really a long shot of some way, it would probably be minimal. Given what a licensing board sees, this is not the sort of thing like having sex with a client or that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So even if they did find in your favor, they would probably only, quote unquote, sentence him to an ethics training or probation for a year or something.
Yeah.
So you just have to consider that whether it would be satisfying to you. You know, sometimes you can work into it like, I demand an apology. On the other hand, you can just directly complain to him. I find that a lot of people don't consider that.
Yeah.
You can write a letter and just mail it to him or email it to him and be like, and just tell him, Yeah. What's going on? I did not appreciate it when you did this. And, you know, maybe that will provide some satisfaction. Right. Maybe it won't. Maybe he'll apologize. Maybe he won't. Maybe he'll defend himself. Maybe, I don't know.
Maybe he'll give corrective information. Like, it didn't have anything to do with the money that you saved.
Yeah.
Maybe that person is even proud of you for looking after yourself in this way, saving your money, which probably wasn't very easy to do this thing, and recognizing your own need. It's like, that's what stood out to me in this story, is they saved their money so that they could look after themselves and take care of this thing. Mm-hmm. Like, that's really freaking cool.
Mm-hmm.
It's really cool.
Yeah. So it sucks. And
yeah.
It's normal to want, especially when you're that hurt, you're that angry.
Yeah.
It sounds like you might be angry, that you want someone to, you know, get their just dessert or something. And that isn't really usually possible in these scenarios. But I'm guessing, as Bob is pointing out, what you want is validation. From us, and maybe from him. Yeah. Imagine if that could happen. You know, there's a risk there.
Yeah.
If you send the letter and he just doesn't reply or defends himself, it could make it worse.
Yeah.
So, you know, again, talk with a therapist about that.
Right.
All right. Well, that does it for that episode of Psychology in Seattle, Bob.
Yeah.
We have a lot more emails. It's funny. So in one of our more recent episodes last month, at the end of the episode, I was like, hey, we finished all the emails. And someone emailed in or commented or something, and they're like, wow, so Kirk doesn't have any emails. Let's start sending him emails. I want to be clear. Only the emails that are in the Bob document were completed. The email documents that I have are a lot longer.
Plenty left to do, eh?
Yeah. There's only I would say one out of every 40 emails is applicable to Bob and me. So I have a lot more emails than that. Plus, a lot of even Bob applicable emails keep coming in.
Oh,
so anyway, and along these lines, I just want to remind everybody that we are now at a place as a podcast where it's not possible for us to answer everyone's emails.
Oh.
And that sucks.
Yeah.
And I know the feeling. I know I've been there. I've emailed a podcast, or I've left a voicemail for a podcast. And when they don't, I think about the wording. I try to make it as heartfelt and as, I try to prove that I'm a true fan. Yep. And to get nothing back, it sucks.
Yeah.
What I'll say is, the average podcast doesn't reply to anybody, email or podcast-wise.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. Oh. Like, the fact that we even reply verbally or through email to anybody is kind of rare. I mean, there are some content providers that are just constantly replying to everybody on TikTok or something, but I will say that I feel some solace in that I'm doing better than a lot of others, you know? Like, I was talking to the very first psychology podcaster, Dr. Dave.
Dr. Dave, yeah.
And did you ever listen to this podcast?
Because
you don't listen
to podcasts.
I was asking him, when I was interviewing him, I asked him, I don't know how we got to this topic, but I said, well, aren't you interested in what your listeners think? Or aren't you interested in their thoughts or their questions? And he just had immediate, no. And I just thought, I think a lot of content providers, they just
not interested.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, I don't know. I can't relate to that. So I've always been interested because I want that relationship, that contact.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to just talk into a microphone and have it go out. I
want
to...
You want there to be an exchange of whatever there can be.
A human exchange, yeah.
Yeah.
And so anyway, so I take some solace in the fact that we do some of it. But, you know, I get it. There are some times when I'll skim an email and I don't even have time. You know, it's funny. There's another YouTuber that I watch, he repairs guitars.
Neat.
T. Woodford is his handle. And
that's an app name.
And he just repairs old acoustic guitars and electric guitars for 45 minutes. And he has this very soothing voice and he'll talk about things. And I just watch him and I just love it. And he said one time, he's like, I get a lot of emails inquiring about fixing people's guitars from all over the world. And the truth is that 99% of the inquiries I can't get to because of time, but also it's economically not feasible. Someone will have a $200 guitar from, they live in Europe and I'm in Canada. For them to ship it to me, it would be like inordinate amount of money for me to do work that they could just take down to their local shop and they could do the work. Like you don't ship it to me for that. That's not good for you.
Right.
And so he has all this, you know, all these responses that he has to tell people. He feels obligated to reply. And so he did the math, and he's actually counted how many emails he gets in a year. And he says that he gets X amount per year. And he's like, on a good day, let's say it takes me 2 minutes to reply to an email, to think about a response and type it out and da da da. And if, when you calculate that out, it equals like a month and a half of full-time job work. Because, you know, when you think about, okay, it just takes 2 minutes to reply.
It never takes me 2 minutes to write an email.
Right. But when you add up all of the emails, and, you know, getting into the mindset, sitting down, it adds up.
Yeah.
You know, it and so I want to say that, because when he was saying that, I was like, I never had thought about that's the reality that I go through, and I get way more emails than this guy does, and I can't reply in 2 minutes. You know, there's so much involved in what people are asking of me. And so I just want to put out there, and I've said this before, but I'm reminded of people feeling hurt that we don't get to their emails. And I it's partly my fault, because I kind of set up that expectation in the past that's like, I will do that because I was committed to that.
And you could.
I could, but I can't, and it sucks. So I'll be reading an email and I'll be thinking, this is such a heartfelt, interesting email, and I don't have time, and I think I answered it in a previous episode, so I'm just going to put it aside. It pains me to do that.
Yeah, I bet.
And I know some people are like, well, just reply, and I'm telling you, I wouldn't be on this microphone right now. I wouldn't have time to do that if I did.
If you did.
And it brings a tear to my eye, because I know how that feels, you know? And I know no one thinks that I'm their special podcaster, like they're the only one emailing in, but I don't know. I just want everyone to know.
But when people
that.
Reach out, you'd like to be able to reach back. You just, it's just, you know, you would just want to.
Just can't. Yeah. And also, like, you know, these individuals are spending hours listening to us.
Right.
I can't spend 2 minutes to reply. Apparently, I can't.
Well, 2 minutes or a half an hour or whatever it would take to reply in the way that you want, because you don't want to half ass it.
Yeah.
And you're just letting us know that it's beyond your limits anymore.
Yeah.
It didn't used to be, but now it is.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I mean, maybe I'll get canceled on the internet and my numbers will plummet, and then I could go back to answering. So for people out there, you know, one motivation to get me canceled from you. Do you know what canceled means?
I do.
Oh.
Just plotting how to do it.
Because you're staring at me with a blank stare.
Yeah, and I'm just thinking, oh, let's see, what would it take? Hey, I did my 7th cameo. This morning.
Ooh.
Yeah.
How was it?
It was really nice, you know, like what I get requested to do with a little bit of encouragement or whatever, and I'm happy to do that. And
how's it feel?
It's nice. I mean, it feels a little weird because, you know, I'm not used to, you know, whatever, talking into the camera or whatever. But it's nice, and I'm glad that I can do that, and the feedback I've gotten, not much feedback, but the little bit I've gotten is, you know, that people are happy to get those from me.
The reviews on Cameo.
Yeah. So, and then, you know, I told Colleen about it, and I said, I was joking, I said, well, next time we fight, you can request a cameo. She said, yeah, I'll buy a cameo from you, and you'll have to say what I want. And I say, well, if that's true, then really I'll be buying it. And community property state and all. So I don't know. I actually could happen. She might request a cameo.
It's funny.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was... At the beginning, when Cameo first came out, I had a typical reaction, which is like, oh, there's all these like D-list celebrities that are struggling with their careers, you know, people that aren't getting roles anymore. And they're, I don't know, these online prostitutes essentially that are trying to eke out some level of fame or some level of income. And you're just like, that's kind of sad. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember thinking that in the beginning. Then when Cameo reached out to me out of the blue and said, hey, you should be on Cameo. I was like, huh? And I just thought, no. And then I thought, well, I don't know, maybe let's do an experiment for a month and see how it goes.
See how it goes, yeah.
And then when I started doing it, I realized the magic of it, the way that it feels, you know? The way that I think about it is that I would love to do a cameo for everyone that wanted one for free. Occasionally that would happen in the past. Someone would email in and say like, oh, my wife loves you. Can you give her a birthday blurb that, mm-hmm. you know, record one and right. send it to me and in your podcast style, and then I'll play it for her. And, you know, I would do that sometimes.
Yeah.
But so I wish I could do that for everybody, because I know what it's like to get a cameo mm-hmm. from someone that you love, you know, like, Taylor Rapp from the LA Rams. He used to play for the UW Huskies as a defensive back, mm-hmm. and he's half Asian. Mm-hmm. So I think he's great.
Yeah.
I was a defensive back, and anyway, so I got a cameo from him. My friend got me a cameo from him.
Oh, right on.
And I was just delighted. But it's so dumb, because it's like, I know he doesn't really know me, but it's just delightful. Anyway.
Yeah.
So I would love to do it for everyone, but I can't with time. So no. I kind of consider the fee to be this barrier of entry kind of a thing. You know, it just like limits the number of requests that I get.
So that it is manageable.
Yeah. And also maybe people make sure that it's a special enough event, instead of just like, tell me that I'm tell me good morning today or mm-hmm. something.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's kind of the way I think about it.
Yeah,
about
yeah, it makes sense.
And I pretty quickly started to realize just how nice it felt to be able to give to someone mm-hmm. in this way, mm-hmm. you know, to try to, maybe it's a little piece of advice mm-hmm. or I'll write a song or something. And,
oh, that's nice.
Yeah. I mean, it's just a little quick jingle or something. Mm-hmm. Like someone just asked for a cameo this morning, and so I'm looking forward to doing that. You know, it's a little kind of a bright moment.
Yeah, right on.
I'll say, though, I have to be in the right mood. Like, there are some spans of time, like a few days, where I'm just not in the right mood.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you got to be chipper.
It's true. Like, I never do them on the spot. I always let them percolate, and then I always make sure I shower and shave. Put on a nice shirt.
That's another thing. Like, you can't look like a slob.
No. I'm not going to. And in the meantime, I think about what they said, and I...
Really? So you germinate.
For sure. Huh. And then usually I record like 10 versions of the thing, and then like...
Really?
No, that was dumb. No. I was looking in the wrong place. Or no, you flubbed a word there.
Wow.
No, you know, I don't write it down. I just like...
Wing
get
it.
A sense about what I want to say, and then, you know... Eventually, I'll do a version that I think is, you know, worthy of being sent and says what I want it to say. And
that's a lot of labor, my friend.
Yeah, it's like 10 minutes, 15 minutes, whatever. It's fine.
Yeah.
Yeah, worth it.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And, you know, I imagine I'll get faster as time goes on. So,
yeah.
But,
In the beginning, when I first did them, it would take me like an hour to do one cameo.
Yeah, right.
But now I can do it pretty quickly.
Yeah. So,
but that'll happen sometimes. I'll be like 3 minutes in and I'll flub something. I'll be, and I'll start over again.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Or sometimes my phone, for whatever reason, craps out and I'll record the whole thing and it won't go through.
Oh, bummer.
And I'll be like, it's kind of weird to like start over from the beginning and act like it's the first time kind of a thing.
But it anyway. Is. Yeah.
All right, Bob. Well, that does it for that episode. Everyone, please take care of yourself and get the therapy that you need, because
you deserve it.